Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
9, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, The Mothership, the place that began it all. We actually looked it up today, Corey and Ed, and the podcast, the first one we can find anywhere online, was in September 2015, which is something. And I think it was Corey, Rosa, and Bob Kagan. I'm just throwing that out there. So we're approaching 9 years of this conversation. And I am delighted each and every week when we have it. Of course, this week we are joined, as ever, by Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute. How are you today, Corey?
I am discouraged after Super Tuesday, David.
Tepid Tuesday. Tedious Tuesday. Nothing much super about Tuesday. We are also joined by Edward G. Luce of the Financial Times. How are you doing, Ed?
I'm great, David, on this woeful Wednesday.
Woeful Wednesday. And Alon Pincus, columnist for Ahar Aretz, and diplomat, and bon vivant, and man about Tel Aviv. How are you doing today, Alon?
Fine. All things considered, as they say.
Yeah, all things considered. What I'd like to do is I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the events that kicked off this week here in Washington with the visit over the protests of Benjamin Netanyahu of Benny Gantz to Washington. And then I'd like to move on, and I'm just saying this so all of you can prepare yourselves, for a little bit of a discussion towards the back half of this about what we hope to hear from the president during the State of the Union address on foreign policy issues. But first, Alon, just give us briefly your perspective on how the Gantz visit to the U.S. was perceived in Israel.
Well, okay, the viewers or the listeners should understand and know two, three things before I even begin answering your question. One is that Gantz is head of an opposition party, but is not the head of the opposition per se. He has 12 seats in parliament out of 120, while another party, Mr. Yair Lapid's party, 24. So officially, he's not the head of the opposition. Secondly, 4 or 5 days into the war after October 7th, he joined the war cabinet as a temporary feature, saying this is only going to last for the management of the war, and his relationship throughout has been with Netanyahu has been less than cordial and less than amicable. Three, ever since the constitutional coup that Mr. Netanyahu instigated last year in 2023, Gantz and leading into and throughout this war in the last 5 months, Gantz has been gaining steadily in the polls. And so now, if you look at the polls, he's anywhere between 25 and 35 or 30 seats, which would make him the prime minister if the polls are correct and elections, and the election is held tomorrow. Now, that's just to understand who Benny Gantz is, a former chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces, a former defense minister, not exactly a political maverick, but one that the Americans have concluded is critical to their efforts. Now I go into the visit, and I'll keep it as brief as possible. I think that at some point the U.S. realized, finally, that nothing good will ever happen while Mr. Netanyahu is prime minister. Nothing in the sense of the day after in Gaza, nothing in the sense of who will govern Gaza, nothing in the sense of an international force with an Arab, major Arab component in it in Gaza, nothing in the sense of or in terms of the broader Biden plan or what Tom Friedman called the Biden doctrine, which is not complete, incoherent, has its blemishes, but nonetheless is the only game in town. Now, they can't, and they figured that they cannot affect behavioral change on Netanyahu. So the idea seemed to be, let's rile him and embarrass him and create internal opposition and resistance to him by inviting Gantz to Washington. Now, the game of was he invited or did he invite himself? Did he ask for meetings or meetings offered to him? Is immaterial because it can always it's a murky equation. It always is. Someone calls you and says, "Ask me to get to invite you," and so on and so forth. Now, he went to Washington without gaining approval from Mr. Netanyahu. By law, Mr. Netanyahu is right. You need to get consent and approval from the prime minister. Every minister needs approval and consent to travel abroad, and he needs to state where he's going, who he is meeting, and the purpose of his trip is. Gantz purposely did not do that. The American administration, the Biden administration, gave him a head of state type, outside of meeting Biden, which was in Camp David, preparing for the State of the Union address. Outside of Biden, he met everyone that is anyone in the administration, Vice President Kamala Harris, Secretary of State Blinken, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. He went up to the Hill to meet congressional leaders, et cetera, et cetera. Until now, other than, the expected and the inevitable poisonous arrows hurled at him, fired at him by Netanyahu, it didn't get a lot of traction. I think in the next 2 days it will. When he comes back and begins to sort of reflect or express what he has heard in Washington. I don't think anyone, this is my last observation on this, David, I don't think anyone in Washington thought that by inviting him they're going to facilitate or generate or precipitate an election, but it is and it will shake the coalition. And I think that when it comes on the heels of Defense Minister Gallant taking a harsh position on the conscription of ultra-Orthodox Jews, they think that between those two, between Gantz and Gallant, some political change or some major cracks in the coalition can happen.
What do you think, Corey?
That all of that sounds plausible to me. I do think the administration believed that their early and deep embrace of Israel after the attacks would lead to influence over their choices that it has not. And the flagrancy of some of the comments by members of the Netanyahu government were shocking, I think, to senior people in the White House and have electoral consequences for this Democratic president if he doesn't start tacking to a position that seems less endorsing of some of the most egregious attitudes in the Netanyahu government. So I think the White House is giving a lot of thought to how they can demonstrate that they don't endorse violence by Israeli settlers, and they don't endorse the position, many of the positions of the Netanyahu government, and they want to be seen as trying to precipitate a different kind of Israeli government.
So, Ed, last night after Tepid Tuesday, there were questions posed to a presumptive Republican nominee, former President Donald J. Trump. And one of the questions was about Gaza. And Trump's response, showing his usual foreign policy subtlety and nuance, was, "We just have to finish the job." You know, and so, you know, as the Biden administration is carefully trying to triangulate what position to have, you have Trump taking the position of, you know, kill the Palestinians. So, you know, so how do we assess that?
You know, I think there's no downside to Trump saying this. You know, he was never going to get, you know, the Arab American vote in Michigan. You know, they're either not going to vote, or maybe they'll reluctantly vote for Biden, or maybe they'll vote for Jill Stein or whoever. But I don't see any downside to that. The Republican Party, I used to think of as the Likud Party. I now think of it as the Ben-Gavir Party. It is becoming more cartoonishly extreme in its stance on the Israel-Gaza situation with every week. And so Biden, of course, you know, has got that leeway that you know, it leaves a lot of space for being reasonable to the left of it. I mean, everything is to the left of the Republican Party on Israel. So the question to me is really what Biden can do. Listening to Corey and Elon and Alon about the Gantz visit, is what Biden can do to precipitate a general election, A, and then B, whether it will produce the outcome that we want. And I mean, I've seen different polls. Alon, you're far, far closer to the ground there. I mean, you're on the ground there. But I've seen different polls, including my paper, extrapolated Israeli public opinion polls to show what, this is a few weeks ago, to show what a new Knesset would look like. And it was worryingly, and like the far right parties, you know, were getting like 58 seats, and then the center with Likud.
And no, I have not seen a poll even.
I'll send you the. They were extrapolating the polls to results, and they were getting 58, and then there was 57 for the centrists, and then there was 5 for the Arab parties, which of course are untouchable, right? Now, I'm sure these polls are all over the place, but my point is, you cannot predict the outcome to a general election, can you? Isn't it a bit more fluid than that?
Yeah, no. So answer that question, Alon, and I do. I'd like to limit this conversation to say another 5 minutes before I switch over to the other one. But you and I got into one of our very unusual disagreements on Twitter this morning. It really started my day on the bad foot because I indicated that I thought Netanyahu might not disappear quite as quickly as a lot of people hope, and that he might actually hang on. Now, when I said that, I meant sort of through the fall. I don't mean indefinitely. So, you know, what are the prospects for an election when, and then to Ed's point, how does it turn out? Hey, our friends at the New Republic, PEN America, and the American Library Association are staging a special event in April to fight the book bans that are sweeping our country. At the event, they will unveil the annual list of the top 10 most challenged books of the year and support authors who have been censored. As part of this Right to Read celebration, the sponsors will also be naming the winners of the Toni Morrison Courage Award
for people on the front lines standing up against book bans. Please support this urgent First Amendment cause by visiting tnr.com/donate. That's donate with an exclamation point. This is one of the most important battles for American democracy being fought today. Please make your voice heard by visiting tnr.com/donate today.
Well, okay. We didn't really disagree because you clarified that the only difference between what we said was the durability or the hammer. Okay, so we didn't really disagree. Okay, the polls right now indicate that he is at 19% approval. That 76% of Israelis think he's responsible and accountable, and that over 68%, 68 point something, want him to resign after the war. Some think he should resign immediately, which he will not, some after the war. When the polls, and I'm talking about 6 or 7 polls that I've seen, and again, I'm not a polls freak, and I don't indulge in the polls too much, certainly not when there's no election, certainly not when the Israeli psyche temperature is being taken at this particular moment, and that could lead to some distortions. But if you look at the seat allocation, the current coalition, which is 64 seats out of 120, doesn't even get close to 50. So the extrapolation that you're talking about is new to me. I'm not saying it can't happen, but it is new, completely new to me. Netanyahu's party, Likud, is anywhere between 15 and 20. The right wing is not really, the extreme right wing is keeping steady, maybe a 5-10% increase, but not anything that changes the balance. Now, as for the election, I think we've discussed this, but, you know, for the sake of whoever is watching now or listening now, I'll say it in 20 seconds. There are three ways of this happening. Either Netanyahu announces a new election, which is very unlikely, because based on those polls, he is scared of doing so, and he knows it's politically suicidal. Number two, there are mass demonstrations in the streets that cause a shakeup in the coalition. And finally, the ultra-Orthodox, of all people, decide that they have nothing to lose with a new election and that they're being maligned. And their association with Mr. Netanyahu is damaging them, because they have an almost unmovable block of voters, or unshakable, impenetrable block of voters. They have nothing to fear in terms of an election. They may not win more, but they're certainly not going to lose. The third option, based on your question, David, is what is called a constructive motion of no confidence. That is when 61 members of parliament vote no confidence, but instead of no confidence that leads to the dissolution of parliament, this is a constructive motion of no confidence, which means that the 61 present a name, an alternative prime minister. For example, Mr. Gantz, who announced that he will take over and call for a general election within a year, but now is the time to steady the boat, et cetera, et cetera. Each of these three scenarios can lead to an election well before the fall. Whether that'll happen or not is anyone's guess. I think it will happen. I think, I may be wrong, I think it'll happen before the fall, an election in Israel.
Interesting, and we will have to see. Clearly, the administration has put all their chips on one place on the roulette wheel, and that is, we get a hostage deal, we get a ceasefire. The ceasefire is 40 days. In the 40 days, we get some kind of steps taken that make the invasion or the operation in Rafah unlikely to happen afterwards, and we surge humanitarian aid. And this issue fades into the background somewhat. If that doesn't happen for some reason, I don't see what plan B is. we can talk about it later if you like. But what I'd like to do is to move on for the remaining bit that we've got here to a different subject, and that is the State of the Union. Some people will listen to this on Wednesday. Some people will listen to this on Thursday. The State of the Union is Thursday night. It's a pretty wonky topic, but Corey, we have been wonks for a long time, and we will continue to appeal to the wonk audience that is our base here.
Deep state nerds are the very best nerds.
They're the best of all the nerds. And, you know, if you're a real nerd, you don't just listen to State of the Union in order to hear Marjorie Taylor Greene hoot out some ridiculous thing, which will undoubtedly happen. You're looking for foreign policy insights. So let's start with two questions for each of you. Alon, you can beg off if you don't feel this is your lane, but starting with Corey and with Ed, what percentage of the speech tomorrow night is going to deal with foreign policy, and what would you like to hear him say?
So I think this speech will have more foreign policy than States of the Union speeches typically do for a couple of reasons. First, because I think the Biden White House believes that that it's an advantage they have over Trump. Not clear that's actually going to prove true, but I think they believe that. Second, I think the president's going to lean in hard to the democracy at home, democracy abroad, again, for electoral reasons. Third, because they don't want to talk about the budget, which cuts $10 billion out of the defense budget based on the Fiscal Stability Act that the president and Republicans in the House and Senate agreed to, that will, because of fixed spending requirements in the defense budget, like the automatic pay raise for military members, will actually result in a $49 billion cut to defense spending in the coming year. So they're going to try and talk foreign policy, not defense policy.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. Ed, what do you think? You think he's going to sit there and say, I'm not leaving the room till you fund Ukraine?
I hope so, you know, because we're no closer to that happening. And this is his unique opportunity to shame Mike Johnson and others, to shame either the cowards or the Putinista wing of the Republican Party in prime time. So I hope he will do that. I expect he will in some form or other, and he will get the Marjorie Taylor Greene shouting stuff at him. And he responds well. Biden, you know, is in his element, energetic, and quick-witted when he's got that, when he's feeding. He's a politician. When he's feeding from the energy of the crowd and the audience, the cameras, the moment. So I expect and hope a Ukraine, a big Ukraine sort of rhetorical piece to this State of the Union. It is going to be more of a foreign policy year than most presidential elections are. Usually we expect foreign policy will play a role, and hardly ever does it actually play a decisive role. I think that 2024, precisely because Biden's campaign, as Corey said, is based on preservation of democracy at home, that obviously links into Trump and Trump's admiration for Putin and the darkness sort of underlying that. I think that makes foreign policy far more integral to Biden's overall message this year. So I would agree with Corey. We're going to get a higher percentage than usual of the State of the Union devoted to foreign policy. Politics stopped, used to stop at the water's edge. That's so outdated now. The foreign policy will be controversial in this speech. There will be moments there that the Biden people think will benefit him.
Before I go on to Alon, Corey, you almost never wince when Ed is speaking, but I saw a slight twitch.
Given that the president's age is a major reason why many Americans are concerned about him running for a second term. I did wince at Ed's description of him as energetic and humorous.
No, I don't think generally he's been coming across like that. But the last State of the Union, he did off-the-cuff riposts that showed him up well and polled well. And, you know, 100 times more people are going to notice this.
Yeah, no, he did. One of his, perhaps the rhetorical high watermark of Joe Biden's career, and, you know, we could discuss whether it's a high bar or a low bar later, was during the State of the Union last year, when just off the cuff, he said, okay, so you're not going to cut Social Security or whatever it was that he said. And he essentially got, you know, agreement from the crowd in real time on that issue. It was a pretty nice turn in the remarks. And it was his kind of high energy mark, too. I know your point. I'm just saying he did okay last year.
One more thing.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me that given that a major part of the president's job is delivering legislation, that unless he has a whole year of executive orders and nothing else, and especially if he hasn't gotten Ukraine aid across the line, it's not clear to me that a red in tooth and claw State of the Union is actually going to be in the president's interests.
Interesting. Okay, so this is the point in the show where we say thanks to everybody who has been listening, and who, those of you who are not members, we say you should be a member because you get 33% more podcasts. This one and all the others that we do, and we do a lot of them. So that's a lot more. And the price is low, and we appreciate it. We're a tiny, tiny little company, and it helps us to keep puttering along as we have these past number of years. But if you're not a member, bye-bye. And if you are a member, stand by.